This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features hands-free calling. Just say the name of the person you want to call, and Sync dials the number, which means you can keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, a conversation with Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, a monumental history of the Black migration.
I mean, we all are here because someone in our background and our history took this great leap of faith to go to a place far away in hopes that life would be better, and that's what they did.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Sean Wilentz takes us inside the world of Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan has a way of picking up on so many different layers of American culture in particular, and then to reform them into 3, 4, 5, even 11-minute songs.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. It's one of the greatest stories in modern American history, the great Black migration from the South to the North, and it's now the subject of a monumental new book. It's called The Warmth of Other Suns. It's by a former Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Isabel Wilkerson, and it's reviewed on our cover by another Pulitzer Prize winner, David Oshinsky, who says it is a massive and masterly book. I'm delighted that Isabel is here with us to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, now, writing this book was not quite as huge an undertaking as the migration itself, but it sounds as if you relived a lot of it. How did you do it? Where did you start?
It was a journey unto itself. First, I had to figure out what was it that I wanted to tell. I had an idea for telling the story through three people who left different parts of the South for different cities in the North.
Roughly when?
Roughly for three different decades in the migration. I wanted to be able to show the breadth and the width of the migration because it was not a singular year or a couple of years. It went on for 55 years, so a good chunk of the 20th century. And in order to do that, I wanted to have three people who left in three of the decades of that migration.
And who are they?
They are first a sharecropper's wife in Mississippi who left with her family in the 1930s. Secondly, a man who had gone to college and had to drop out of college after the money ran out, ended up working as a citrus picker in Florida and tried to improve the wages of the people who were very poorly paid under the circumstances. His employers got quite angry at that, and he had to leave town under threat of death.
And who's the third?
And the third is a surgeon who was attempting to start a career right out of the Army. He was from Louisiana. He found that he was not able to perform surgeries in the South. And so he
said, because of segregation.
Because of segregation.
Totally segregated.
Because of Jim Crow. Well, he couldn't operate in the hospitals in his hometown. And so he set out on a journey across the country to get to California, and it was an arduous one that he had not anticipated.
Now, these are people you interviewed, is that right?
Absolutely.
These are, much of the material in this enormous book does come from archived and documented sources, but you interviewed some 1,200 people for this book, made these three particular stories the prism through which you tell this larger narrative. What are some of the signature events that kind of run through the entire experience of this Black migration? First of all, how many people did it?
6 million people were left the South during the era of the Great Migration. And it was initially thought that by people who were studying it at the time that it would end after World War I, and in fact, it actually grew. Each successive decade during the migration, particularly peaking in World War II, brought more and more people out of the South. It began to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It took on a life of its own to the point where at the beginning of the century, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. And by the end of the migration, nearly half of them were living instead in the North and the West. That's how massive it was.
And they went where? To the great cities where there was industrial employment? What was luring them to the North?
Well, two things. One was the goal of the book in some ways was to help the reader live through the process of the experiences of these people migrating themselves, live through what was going on in the South, and then journey forth with them to the North and West. And there were three migration streams which these people represent. So one of them represents the East Coast migration stream from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, to Washington, Philadelphia, New York.
So
a
straight shot north, basically. Right.
And then the other one was the one that had the most written about it because of the Chicago School of Sociology. But that was the one from Mississippi and Arkansas up to Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, Minneapolis, that area.
So that's kind of a Midwest,
sort of
Great Plains kind
Correct.
Of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Straight
and
up,
then the third?
The Mississippi. And then the third was from Louisiana and Texas to California, the lesser known of the three. And so the goal was to make sure that there was a sense of the national proportions of this migration, and each of these individuals bear that out. You can live through that national migration through their lives.
So in some ways, this almost sounds like the great immigrant stories we hear. So people leave one land for another. So was there also sort of the culture of rumor and legend? If you go to the great big city, there's money to be made, this kind of thing, and falsehoods that would also travel back to these small towns in the South?
There was all of that. There was even a lot of skepticism about whether they could make it or not. There was a lot of research that a lot of the people did, talking to people. They would write to the Chicago Defender to find out if these things that they were hearing were in fact true.
And the Chicago Defender was the great African-American newspaper.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was disseminated nationally, but quietly, surreptitiously through the Pullman porters and others. There's a whole story behind that, too. But essentially, there were many, many rumors and a lot of mythology, but essentially this feeling that they took this great leap of faith into the unknown, which in some ways is the typical great American story. I mean, we all are here because someone in our background and our history took this great leap of faith to go to a place far away in hopes that life would be better, and that's what they did.
You've described what life was like in the Deep South, in the Jim Crow South, and it really is just shocking to read. Why did some people stay? I mean, the stories you tell are almost really difficult to get through at times.
Yeah. In the writing of it, I tended to look to this film that came out in the 80s called The Gods Must Be Crazy. Really, that was the only way that I could get through it. In other words, that was a movie about...
That was the film set in South Africa.
Yes, where people came in from another culture, and they had all these crazy things like Coca-Cola cans. And like, right. What are they doing with a Coca-Cola can? We could just go get water from the well or something, from the river. And it was so absurd that the only way that you could look at it and write about it was to accept it, to look at it as just a moment of insanity, a time of insanity. And that was how I dealt with the approach to writing about the Jim Crow South and the segregation and the extremes to which the South went in order to hold fast the caste system, which is what was ruling all of their lives.
Now, what about life in the North? I mean, there must have been disappointments there, too. It's not as if they really entered a promised land.
No, they did not. No, and so that's dealt with, too. I mean, it was a process of discovery for me because so much of the research meant going into the archives and looking at what was going on at the time and what was being written in the era. And there's one case of a family that was that tried to rent an apartment in Cicero, Illinois, the Harveys. Harvey Clark, rather, and he and his wife and his two children, they were adorable. They could have been on the cover of Life magazine.
Now, what time are we talking about now?
This is 1951.
Okay.
And they tried to get an apartment in Cicero. He was a bus driver and she was working. And when they arrived, all of their things were thrown out of the second floor window. The people were in such a rage that they actually tore out the fixtures from the apartment and threw the toilets and the sinks out of the window, then threw out all their wedding pictures and family pictures and the piano. All of this hurled out of the window, and then all of it set aflame. Then they set the entire building on fire, which left the white people living in the building homeless, too. It was out of control.
Now, what about legal authorities? What were they doing?
They were watching.
They didn't do anything.
They didn't.
Was the quality of racism and segregation in the North different from what it was in the South? Or are they really just the same thing?
I think that they're different. the beauty of the experiences of the people who went to the North, even though it wasn't what they had hoped it would be, perhaps, first of all, their expectations were quite modest. They were coming from such a place of persecution and oppression that anything that would allow them to just walk down the street undisturbed was a step up.
So one step up was something they were willing to settle for.
Willing to settle for. And the beauty of the North and the West for them was that these were big cities, big anonymous cities, where they would in some ways go unnoticed when it came to just getting on a streetcar and being able to sit where they wanted to. Being able to apply for a job and hope that they might get it. Being able to send their children to schools that were superior by definition to anything that they would have had in the South. Those were small goals that they had set for themselves, and that's how one might define success or lack of success when it comes to the migration.
Thanks so much, Isabel.
Thank you.
That's Isabel Wilkerson, whose new book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman is here with notes from the field, or rather, notes from on the road. What's going on, Julie?
Well, this week we had a bit of news from the South, from Charlottesville, Virginia. The Virginia Quarterly Review, which is the literary journal based out of the University of Virginia, it's won a bunch of national magazine awards, is in the midst of a bit of tumult. It is announced that it has canceled its winter issue following the suicide of its managing editor last month and a bit of rebellion from its staff in the weeks afterward.
Julie, it's rare, in fact, almost unheard of for a magazine to actually cancel an issue. What happened?
This has been a very unusual situation. The editor, Ted Genoways, has been accused by the staff. This is a very small staff, about four people, of bullying the managing editor, whose name is Kevin Morrissey, and indirectly causing his suicide last month. Now, the staff has said that Mr. Genoways was abusive in the workplace, that he accused Mr. Morrissey of workplace incompetence, and that essentially drove Mr. Morrissey to such despair that he shot himself.
Oh, my gosh. So the staff is saying then, if I understand, that Mr. Genoways was abusive not only toward Mr. Morrissey, but toward the rest of the staff as well?
That's right. The staff has described a long pattern starting mostly starting last fall, where Mr. Genoways didn't appear in the office as frequently as he should have, leaving much of the management in the hands of Mr. Morrissey, but then at the same time accusing Mr. Morrissey of negligence, telling them he didn't do his job well, sending many, many emails to the staff accusing them of incompetence. And the staff has said that they took their complaints to the university, to the president of the university, John Castine, who is now gone, and that the university did not handle their complaints effectively, and that they essentially didn't address the problem, that they allowed Mr. Genoways to continue in his job, and essentially led Mr. Morrissey to depression and to suicide.
Now, Julie, one reason this story is attracting so much interest is because the Virginia Quarterly Review is not only a distinguished literary publication with a long history, but in recent years, it's really emerged as a very prominent publication in the broader world because of these two editors. Isn't that the case?
That's right. You know, Mr. Genoways, when he came in, he really transformed the magazine. He introduced a lot more color. He made it a more diverse publication. He made a lot of changes and attracted a lot of attention from the wider magazine world. And Mr. Genoways was brought in to do just that. And he and Mr. Morrissey were very much a team. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that things really started to deteriorate, that their relationship started to falter. Some staff members have told me that Mr. Genoways and Mr. Morrissey had a difference of opinion editorially, and that really caused a lot of tension in the office, and that by the end of the summer, the two were not even on speaking terms.
And what's the atmosphere there? Have you managed to speak to a lot of people?
Well, right now, there is no atmosphere because the offices have been closed down. The university has said that the staff needed a break, and this is down to about three people now, because one of the staff members has resigned after he was accused of unprofessional workplace conduct by Mr. Genoese. So that staff member has resigned. There are two staff members who remain, and they are on paid leave. The offices are closed down, the doors are locked, and the university has appointed an independent review to conduct an investigation and find out what happened. There's a new president at the university, and she has said that she wants to find out what went wrong here, and she hopes that that investigation will be finished sometime this month. But until the investigation is concluded, the Virginia Quarterly Review is not going to publish.
And what about Mr. Genoese? Has he defended himself? Has he offered an explanation? Has he been talking to people like you?
Mr. Genoese has hired a lawyer who's done a lot of the speaking for him. He has vehemently denied any wrongdoing. He has said that Mr. Morrissey suffered from depression his whole life, and that any kind of workplace conflict was normal. Now, Mr. Morrissey's sister, who lives in Austin, has been extremely vocal in the press and in the blogs, and has told anyone who will listen that Mr. Genoese is very much responsible for causing her brother a lot of pain and a lot of despair.
It's a terrible story. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
This New York Times podcast is brought to you by Ford and voice-activated Sync, the in-car connectivity system that features hands-free calling. Sync connects to most Bluetooth-enabled phones and then listens to the sound of your voice. So just say the name of the person you want to call, and Sync dials their number. With Sync, you'll never miss a call, and you can keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel. Sync is a system that's subscription-free, and it's available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com.
Williams and Zinger killed poor Hattie Carroll with a cane that he twirled around his diamond ring finger at a Baltimore hotel society gathering. Then the cops was called in and his weapon took from him as they rode him in custody down to the station and booked Williams and Zinger for first-degree murder.
If there's anything more to learn about Bob Dylan, then the great historian Sean Wilentz is the one to tell us. He's got a new book. It's called Bob Dylan in America. It's reviewed for us by Bruce Handy, who says Wilentz possesses the rare virtues of modesty, nuance, and lucidity, and he should be celebrated and treasured for that. He also says Wilentz is very, very good on the actual music. I'm delighted that Sean Wilentz is here to talk about his book. Welcome, Sean.
Great to be here, Sam.
Okay, Sean, Dylan's been written about a lot. He wrote an extraordinary memoir.
Yes.
Probably a classic of American autobiography. Your book is called Bob Dylan in America. What are you saying?
Right. Well, part of that is a tip of the hat to Jane Kramer, who wrote a book called Allen Ginsberg in America some many years ago, and which I admire a great deal. What I really wanted to find out was what America has to tell us about Bob Dylan and what Bob Dylan has to tell us about America over his very long, nearly 50-year career.
Let's talk about the culture that helped form him.
Yeah, well, he came out of Minnesota, as people know, in the 1940s. You know, Bob Dylan may own the 1960s, but he's a product of the 1940s and 1950s. And a great deal of his musical imagination, a great deal of his literary imagination comes out of those times. And I wanted to make that clear, going back to the popular front politics of the 1940s, which precede him, but which came up and helped form the folk revival, which formed him. There's a backstory there that had to be told.
Now, when you talk about the popular front, you mean the very left-wing progressive politics in America.
That's right.
It came out of the New Deal, almost a kind of revolutionary politics.
Well, it was the Communist Party. I mean, the Communist Party in the 1930s had a change of line and moved from a very militant stance to one where they would try to reach out to liberals and so forth to defend the Communist Party against fascism. That all changed in 1941. Then they went back to the popular front in the 40s, and it became not just a Communist Party thing or a left-wing thing. It actually seeped out into mainstream culture during World War II in the fight against the fascists. Now, there was a lot of stuff out there, novels, radio shows, you name it. I write about Aaron Copland, who was actually on the left in the 30s, was actually friends with Pete Seeger's father, among other things. I mean, this is a connection I wasn't expecting to run into, but there it was. His music, which elevates American popular music and American folk song to the level of art, is very much in that popular front vein. Now, I'm not saying that Bob Dylan is a popular front artist. What I'm saying is that the culture that he was born into helped form him, and that was part of the culture that he was born into, a very important one, and one that he picked up on right away when he came to New York in 1961.
Where will some of those influences show? What songs or what tonalities that we might hear in Dylan come out of this culture you're talking about?
Oh, I mean, the use of folk song, old folk songs going back to 16th and 17th century England, and then adapting them in new ways in some topical songs. I mean, some of the topical songs that you hear about, the times they are a change and you name it, were very influenced not just by Woody Guthrie specifically, the name that we usually think about, but by this broader world of the Almanac Singers and Pete Seeger and the attempt to try and go to the people with ideas as well as with stories, stories that were political, stories that had a political valence. What Dylan did was to move beyond the more didactic or the more straightforward kinds of political songs and write a song like The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, which is a story about a very small incident, one that most people would have forgotten about, the death of a servant, and turn that into something that was much larger. That was something that he had a gift for. So in a sense, he was picking up on the popular front folk revival, but he's also extending it.
Okay, so now we know the influences that formed him. Now, how does Dylan form America? Here's someone for you and I are, you know, same generation.
Yep.
We could have a conversation with people like us who would say Dylan might actually be the single greatest artist of his time in any medium. That's not an implausible argument.
I wouldn't argue with it.
What did he do to shape the way Americans viewed themselves or viewed art?
Bob Dylan had a way of picking up on, has a way of picking up on so many different layers of American culture, and not just American culture, but American culture in particular, and then to reform them, to compress them into 3, 4, 5, even 11-minute songs in a way unlike anyone else. In a Bob Dylan song, you don't know if you're getting Herman Melville or if you're getting Louis Jordan or if you're getting any number of other, Bing Crosby or Little Richard. It's all there in Dylan's work.
And how conscious is he of the particular sources he's drawing on? I've heard people say, here's the line from Melville that you will hear echoed in this particular song, that it's that deliberate, almost like a poet.
Well, I think that's right. I think it is like a poet, but the influences on a poet are sometimes quite conscious, sometimes not. One gets the impression that Bob Dylan reads and listens to a great deal of stuff and things are going to stick. Some things are so exact that it's pretty clear that he's found a great line and he wants to use it, but in a very different context. I know there's been a controversy about his so-called plagiarism, which I think completely misses the point of what an artist is about. Every artist uses everything that's available to him or her and makes of it, out of it, art. But Bob Dylan has not just a great background and a great sensitivity to all of the things, all of the nuances of art, but he's able to express something about ourselves. And that's because he has an unusual seismograph on the culture. He can tell what's going on and express it before anybody else can. That's what a great artist does. That's what he does.
Sean, Bruce Handy, our reviewer, who's extremely knowledgeable about popular music, says one of the real highlights of this book is your account of the recording sessions for the great Blonde on Blonde album. And I think Handy writes that it's as good as the pages Dylan somehow didn't write himself in his own memoir. Well, you actually talked to some of the musicians.
I did. There have been some interviews about that. This is a mythical event. This is the album where Dylan left New York, went to Nashville. It was New York, you know, 1965, 66 hip coming up against what was still, you know, 1950s, 1960s Nashville, which was a very different kind of culture.
And these are country artists.
These are country artists. They're the best session men in Nashville. And the collision there produced, or the meeting of those forces produced Blonde on Blonde. Well, what I wanted to do in that chapter is to try and translate what had become a mythical event into an historical event. To actually try to find out what happened, because there's a lot of mystery about that, right down to the musicians that appear on some of the songs. One of the songs on the album, One of Us Must Know Sooner or Later, was actually recorded in New York, not in Nashville. And I think actually is musically, at least, one of the strongest tracks on that album. The musicians who performed on it have never been really given the proper credit because they don't show up on the liner notes, they don't show up on the album cover. Paul Griffin, Rick Danko, and Bobby Gregg really make that song very, very powerful, quite apart from what Dylan has to contribute. But to understand what went into it, what happened, how it happened, how the songs developed, often in the studio, very late at night. Dylan would be working there constantly. And the musicians were so good that they could get it very, very quickly.
Which raises another question. What did these super professionalized studio pros make of a guy like Dylan? Do they see him as a fellow musician?
Well, they do. They didn't know quite what to make of him. I mean, he comes this long-haired, you know, sort of weird guy with his long-haired weird friends, particularly Al Cooper. Well, Al Cooper and Robbie Robertson. Those are the two musicians that accompanied Dylan to Nashville. But in my interview with Al Cooper, I did talk to a couple of the musicians who were there, and Cooper said that he had never felt more welcomed in by musicians, that these were pros who understood what music was about. They caught into what Dylan was doing. Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands took a while, so Kenny Buttrey has a quote somewhere that I got from somebody else's interview, saying, you know, by the time we got to verse 3, we thought, this is about it, right? And they keep going and going. We peaked 10 minutes ago. You know, where is this happening? So they weren't completely aware of what was going on. So it was a wonderful meeting of New York hip Bob Dylan poetry in his American form with a different America. And out of that came two Americas kind of came together there, or you could see it that way, and produced a masterpiece.
Thanks a lot, Sean.
Thank you.
That's Sean Wilentz, whose new book, Bob Dylan in America, is reviewed in this week's book review.
I didn't mean to treat you so bad. You shouldn't take it so personal. I didn't mean to make you so sad.
Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Everything Old is New Again. Justin Halpern is still on top of the nonfiction list with Stuff My Dad Says. Boy, I'm getting sick of saying that.
I want to know what his mom says.
Good point. And Elizabeth Gilbert, actually, is back at number 2 with her book, Committed. It was published back in January, had a decent run, and now it's back, thanks to the wild success of the movie Eat, Pray, Love.
Based on her first mega bestseller.
Yep, which is on top of the paperback list, so no crying for her.
And fiction?
James Patterson is back on top of the fiction list with his latest, The Postcard Killers, co-written with Liza Markland. You may ask, did James Patterson ever really go away? And no, he's got another novel at number 12, Private, that was published a couple of months ago. It's still down at number 12, that one he wrote with Maxine Petro. The Postcard Killers is kind of an interesting project for Patterson. He often works with co-authors, but this time he teamed up with Markland, who's one of Sweden's best-selling crime novelists. And she's also a journalist. She's written a number of very successful books. Like her compatriot Stieg Larsson, she's very focused on violence against women. The conceit of this book is pretty clever. It's about a New York police detective who joins up with a Swedish reporter to hunt down some perverted Killers. And if that sounds a little bit Larsonian to you, the two authors insist that they conceived of their partnership before the whole Stieg Larsson mania really took off.
So it may be Larsonian, but it's not larceny.
Very good.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.